Shrink Wrap Radio number 475, The Social and Psychological Impact of Robotics, with New York Times journalist John Markoff.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is John Markoff, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times science writer and author of the 2015 book, Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots. For more information about John Markoff, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. John Markoff, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, it's been about 34 years since you interviewed me for InfoWorld on the future of video games, so it's nice to have the opportunity to return the favor.
That's neat. 34 years has been a while.
Yeah, really. But I've been following you. We were both very young in our careers at the time. As I recall, you approached me because I was both a psychology professor and a market research consultant who had done research for the likes of Atari, Apple, Electronic Arts, and so on. And, you know, I looked back at the interview you did with me then, because I kept a copy for my archives, and I'm happy to report that all my predictions about the future of video games came true.
I've forgotten. What did you predict?
Oh, let's see. I think I was, it's been a little while since I looked at it to check, but I think one of the things I predicted was possible use for educational purposes and training. And certainly we've seen it move in that direction. And I forgot what other wonderful predictions I made. I should have brushed up on that. It occurred to me that you might ask me that. Yeah, by the way, I see that you're a Pulitzer Prize winner. Please accept my belated congratulations. What was the work for which the prize was awarded?
Well, there was a series of stories that appeared in the Times in 2012, largely about Apple's manufacturing practices in China.
Uh-huh.
The piece that I wrote was really about the future of manufacturing and dealt with AI and robotics.
Okay, that's right on point. And I remember that there was a big flap about that, and there was a story on NPR that later was retracted. I'm sure you probably are aware of all that, right?
That's right. There was a lot of controversy around it. And I tried to go to China during that period. I was interested in the use of robotics in China. And because of the sort of situation between the Times and the Chinese government, I was not able to get a visa. So I ended up going to Europe instead.
Okay. That's not too bad.
No, it was worked out okay.
Yeah. Now, I don't know whether to hope that the predictions, you know, speaking of predictions, I don't know whether to hope that the predictions in your book come true or not. I very much see your book like Rachel Carson's The Silent Spring, which alerted us to the coming ecological disaster. And you're sounding a strong warning about a potential technological one. That just occurred to me this morning as I was dipping back into the book.
Yeah, I think that's fair, although I'm much more of two minds. I can see several outcomes, and I'm not entirely pessimistic. I mean, I wrote the book because I see designers, human designers, having so much of a role in the outcome, which I take as a potentially optimistic possibility.
Pogo who's quoted as saying, "I've seen the enemy, and they are us"?
Exactly. Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, and it seemed particularly appropriate. Again, that came to me as I was dipping back into the book this morning. Well, the title of your book is Machines of Loving Grace. I almost said madness. I think there must be something Freudian going on there. Machines of Loving Grace, the Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots, which I have to say I was thrilled to discover because before I heard about it, I was already editorializing about robots in my monthly newsletter as a result of recent films such as Her, Ex Machina, and Tomorrowland, as well as hearing an interview with Martin Ford, author of the book Rise of the Robots.
That's right. It seems like it's everywhere, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it does. And robots have been very much on my mind. And to tell you a funny story, when I was in graduate school, I was doing a clinical psychology internship at the VA hospital in Allen Park, Michigan. I received a letter from someone who I did not know from outside the system somewhere telling me that in my past life, I had been a robot maker in Atlantis, and that in this incarnation, my purpose was to work out that karma. And it seems kind of amazing reflecting back on that.
That seems reasonable.
Yeah. It's kind of, in some ways, it seems like it could be true. The way I discovered your book was your NPR interview with Terry Gross. And so I immediately reached out to contact you after hearing that interview and was very gratified that you responded positively.
And
I have to say, reading your book was like candy for me, which is to say I gobbled it up. Technology has always been a big part of my own passion. I really am reflexively a technophile, even though in recent years I've started to reflect on the shadow side of technology and some very good books that were written 10 or 15 years ago that started getting my thinking going in that direction. In her interview, Terry focused most of her attention on your chapter about driverless autonomous automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
And just another little story, I was on a long walk with my 7-year-old granddaughter. And kind of out of the blue, she said, you know, my first car is going to be, I don't remember the word she used, but it was essentially driverless. I don't know where she got that idea. And I thought, my God, she could be right. She could be right. So, yeah.
Well, today, there's a story saying that the Apple's first electric car will come in 2019.
Uh-huh.
So maybe she'll have an Apple.
Yeah, they'll have the kinks worked out by the time she's ready to drive. So since I'm sure my listeners can find that interview with Terry Gross by searching on the web, I'm going to focus our conversation mostly on some of the other topics in your book. And if you feel absolutely compelled to talk about driverless cars, feel free.
No. Let's go elsewhere.
Okay. And of course, me being a psychologist as well as a market researcher still after all these years, this is a psychology podcast. So as we go along, I'm interested in the psychological and social aspects wherever they might apply. And also I was both gratified and horrified to see that there were actually several psychologists mentioned in the history as you recounted it, some on one side, some on the other. So to jump into it, the big theme that runs through your book, we might characterize as AI versus IA. So perhaps you can unpack those initials for us as well as their significance.
Sure. The observation that was my starting point for this book really grew out of a book I wrote a decade ago called What the Dormouse Said, How the 60s Counterculture Shaped the Personal Computer. And at the time, there were two laboratories in the 1960s, two computing research laboratories that were both created in the early 1960s. One was created by a man by the name of John McCarthy. And McCarthy had coined the term artificial intelligence in the 1950s, and he really was already one of the most significant figures in the computer industry. And he came to Stanford in 62 and proceeded to create a research lab called the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. And he believed in 62 that it would take him a decade to create a working AI, basically to displace humans, to build a machine that would do everything that a human would be able to do. And then on the other side of campus, there was another laboratory created by a man by the name of Doug Engelbart. And Engelbart in 62, 63 set out to create a laboratory called the Augmentation Research Center. And, you know, you probably know Engelbart because he was the inventor of the computer mouse, and he invented hypertext, which led to the World Wide Web. And he really sort of took it upon himself during the 1950s to make it his life's goal to use computing to build technologies that would augment human intelligence. And he really thought he could build tools for small groups of human workers to make them more effective and to sort of be sort of intellectual prosthesis for the humans. And I realized, 10 years ago that those were two different philosophical approaches. And in fact, in the intervening period between the 60s and today, there have been these separate communities within computer science, the AI community. And then Engelbart coined the term intelligence augmentation. And that became the human and computer interaction community. Lots of psychologists on both sides of the fence. Uh-huh. cognitive scientists doing both. I realized that the puzzle that I was trying to solve in writing this book was there's a dichotomy between those two worlds, but it's also a paradox, because even when you augment human intelligence, you potentially displace humans as well. And I really don't claim to have an answer, but I do think it's rooted in human design, wherever that answer is. And I looked at a group of people, a number of people who were designers on both sides of the coin, and particularly people who crossed over from AI to IA. I was very interested in that.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned prosthesis, and I only half-jokingly tend to refer to Siri and particularly to Google as a prosthesis for my brain.
I agree.
Which I increasingly rely on.
Well, you know, and it was Steve Jobs, probably somebody coined this phrase first, but Jobs referred to the personal computer as a bicycle for the mind. Yeah. And I think that's a wonderfully evocative phrase in the best sense of the potential of personal computing.
Yeah, me too. I was fascinated by the issue that you raised in terms of whether digital technology will be used to replace humans or to assist humans, and that's basically what that dichotomy is about. It never occurred to me to think about it in those terms, and I guess one of the main points of your book is that it may not have occurred to at least some of the people who are designing these systems. Do I have that right?
Yeah, well, I think it's a matter of orientation and values. There are people who I spent time with who are really sort of captivated with the Engelbartian idea and values. There are a number of people who really put the human at the center of their design. And then I also increasingly found, I found a number of people in my research who, were influenced by science fiction movies. I can't tell you how many people I stumbled across who decided to go into AI because they saw Space Odyssey 2001 and they wanted to build HAL.
Wow.
Which was not my reaction. But, people like Rod Brooks and Jerry Kaplan, both well-known early people in roboticists and AI, really were sort of inspired by that movie. That was very striking to me, how science fiction and the sort of visions that it creates of the world can actually affect the actual world. And I saw that.
You know, speaking of science fiction, I remember that you cited two science fiction books that you thought were maybe the best around on this topic, and now I can't find that reference. Do you remember those two titles?
I wonder if I was talking about, I have some favorites, and I don't know which particular topic it was. I mean, certainly, Blade Runner as a movie was evocative, and in terms of books, both Snow Crash and Neuromancer were important books.
Aren't the ones. I've read both of those.
I wonder which two at this point, I'm not sure what I was specifically referring
I'll just
to.
Have to go back. Maybe novel is in the index. I don't know. I'll hope. Or science fiction. Maybe it'll come up under that.
Or I'll think some more while we're talking.
Okay. Well, before we go any further, I should probably you know, get you to say something about the difference between robots and artificial intelligence, in as much as the subtitle of your book is the quest for common ground between humans and robots, and yet most of the focus of your book is on, quotes, artificial intelligence. So I know there's great overlap, but what would you like to...
So you mean about robotics in particular, or...
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is I want to make sure that our audience understands that robotics refers to those more or less human-looking things.
Yeah, although a self-driving car I would call a robot. I mean, I have a very broad definition of robotics, and if you sort of get it in and try to find formal definitions, it gets messy. I mean, there are some people who believe that a robot is only a device that is autonomous, and yet in conventional sort of idiom, we've referred to teleoperated devices as robotic too. And I've chosen to sort of take a broad brush. So even a Siri, I consider Siri to be a software robot.
Mm-hmm. Right,
or you could call it an AI of some kind. The terminology is not precise, I think, is the way to describe it.
Right, right. And you point out that the tension between systems designed to replace humans versus systems designed to augment our abilities has a long history. And you've already told us about Doug Engelbart and John McCarthy. Also, Marvin Minsky was, I guess, on the McCarthy side. More so.
He was a little bit nuanced. But, yeah, he was close to McCarthy, and they both created the first two laboratories, you know. McCarthy and Minsky built the MIT AI lab before McCarthy moved east.
Yeah.
And Minsky's continued to write about the subject of building machines that, you know, replicate all human capabilities.
I don't know how you wrapped your mind around this huge topic, because your book really is like a history book, because there are names of people, I think, on every page. I'm not sure I encountered a page that didn't name some of these leading characters. And often we were coming back to them. You know, we'd read all about them, we thought, in one chapter, and then in the next chapter, oh, here they are again.
Yeah, so that's probably a fair criticism. There was also, I thought, a fair criticism of my previous book, is that after I started Dormouse, I realized that it probably would have been easier to synthesize everything if I had made it a biography of Engelbart. But when I started there, I realized that there was another biography that had already been written, and I sort of shied away, and then I realized that there still needs to be another great Engelbart biography written, which hasn't happened yet. And the same token, I came to this book, and I originally started it as just two stories of two people that I thought embodied these ideas of IA and AI, and then at the last moment, fairly far into the project, one of them refused to cooperate with me.
Oh, no.
And so for a while I was slightly suicidal, and then I decided that I needed to finish this, and the two ideas were strong enough. And I think that's why you see so many examples, is I was trying to be, you know, thematic and focused on the ideas and use these people and their decisions and what they did as the basis for illustrating this dichotomy.
Yeah, well, it was an effective approach, I think, and it really brought home the key ideas kind of being illustrated in over and over again in different kinds of settings. One of the concepts that you cover is liberation technologies. An interesting phrase reminds me of liberation theology. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. So that was a group that was created by a couple of scientists from diverse areas, social scientists and technical scientists at Stanford. And it's still an active group. And, it fits within the field. The modern part of the sort of academic part of that field is called human-computer interaction, and that's human-centric design. And I think what the folks in the Liberation Technology Group at Stanford have done is they've tried to, if you will, they've tried to socialize the idea. They've tried to sort of explore it, human-centered design, within a political context, and it's very much part and parcel of Terry Winograd, his view of the world. Terry was a pioneering AI designer who in the 1980s basically gave up on the field and walked away. And he pursued a very different direction, which was around human-computer interaction design, HCI. And, there's a political component to their sort of work as designers. They want to build systems that, invoke and support community in addition to just purely technical design.
Yeah. Thank goodness that there are people like that. It's reminiscent of the early days of computing and the Apple II and all of that. And the idea of empowering us, which certainly it has done in some ways or many ways.
Yeah.
The other side of the coin is captured very powerfully when you write, and there's so many great quotes. I mean, I was marking my book up like crazy. And
That's neat.
But, there are ones where you really sock it to the reader. You write, "The new ethical dilemma is, will humans allow their weapons to pull triggers on their own without human oversight?"
Yeah.
You want to say something about that?
Sure, I can say a lot. So there is an international political movement now called the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots. And it's in some ways it is a successor organization to an organization of computer scientists that was created in the 1980s called and was actually created in part by Terry Winograd called Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, that embodied this notion of the human in the loop and the ethical judgments that a human in the loop should make. The organization, the Campaign to Stop the Killer Robots, has started now because we're starting to see a generation of new kinds of weapon systems that basically sort of separate killing from the human being. Not the victim, but the killer.
Yeah.
In the United States now, more than half of the military air vehicles are teleoperated drones.
I didn't know that. More than half.
They have thousands and thousands of drones like Predators and Global Hawks and all kinds of other vehicles, and those are largely now still human controlled, although it's really quite striking. One of the surprising things that I found in studying one of the weapon systems called the Predator, which is now used all over the world to extend the reach of the American military, is it in any Predator mission, there may be as many as 150 to 170 humans involved. Everything from intelligence analysts to pilots to lawyers who oversee decisions on killing.
Wow.
And those are what you would call semi-autonomous weapons. The weapons themselves don't decide who to kill or where to kill. The United States in particular does not have at the moment any purely autonomous weapons in our arsenal. We are designing a weapon system called LRASM, long-range anti-ship missile, that's designed for the Pacific military theater. I think it'll be deployed probably in 2018. And it's what's called a semi-autonomous weapon in that it's got to fly from a carrier or from an aircraft perhaps 500 or 600 miles. And the last 300 miles, it does it without any contact with humans or networks or anything else. And the reason they call it semi-autonomous is that a human picks the target. But then when it gets to the enemy fleet, it will use AI software to decide what the target actually, where the target the human specified is. So it's a slippery slope. If you think about autonomous killing, a landmine is an autonomous weapon. It's just a really stupid autonomous weapon.
Uh-huh.
But you can see that these weapons, because of the falling cost of computing and the falling cost of sensors and increasingly more powerful sensors, these weapons are going to be with us, whether we like it or not. They're just too easy to design. And, I'm actually tremendously concerned about the deployment of those technologies for a lot of reasons. One is, I think, that has not been widely discussed is if you think about these weapon systems in the hands of small dictatorships, it will make it easier for a dictator to control a population. And even to the point of, think about putting face recognition technologies on airborne platforms to look for humans on the ground below. I am virtually certain that that will happen. I mean, in effect, it probably is already happening today with the U.S. using various communications technologies to track people. And face recognition would just be an additional mechanism. And that, I think that's as close to Terminator as you can possibly imagine without assuming self-aware machines.
Yeah, you know, I think based on what I read in your book, that the only thing that doesn't exist already in the Terminator superior, in the Terminator scenario, is time travel, where the Terminator's coming from the future. But you kind of actually explicitly say that all of the components of the Terminator scenario, like robots that can climb ladders and robots that can bust down doors, etc., and certainly robots that can fire weapons, that all of that already exists.
Well, up to, yeah, so there's a distinction I'd like to make in terms of that. I don't think we're close to actually designing what are called self-aware machines yet. Certainly there's lots of autonomy, and I'd make a distinction between autonomous systems, machines that can make decisions, and machines that actually think in a human sense. And I don't think we're anywhere near humans that think in a human sense. And at least the Terminator in the science fiction movie appeared to be a self-aware machine.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I'm also struck by another powerful quote, "Artificial intelligence is poised to have an impact on society that will be greater than the effect that personal computing and the internet have had beginning in the 1990s. Significantly, the transformation is being shepherded by a group of elite technologists."
Yeah.
You want to talk about
sure.
that?
Sure.
Your whole book is about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, that at this point, I think I have to say that point about AI and robotics versus personal computing and the internet is a reporting hypothesis on my part. I mean, I made a bet that this was going to be a very big deal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have a good friend, Paul Saffo, who's been a longtime observer of Silicon Valley. And one of the things that Paul says is never mistake a clear view for a short distance. And so the time frame is one that I go back and forth on. And I think it's really one of the sort of what foibles of Silicon Valley is we think that the people who spend their time in Silicon Valley have a real faith that these technologies are all accelerating and that the future is going to be here quicker than we might imagine. And, you know, I think it's patchy that there will be advances in some areas and not in others. And so I can see the impact of AI, for example, on the workforce. And I am watching a very, very lively debate about how widespread and how quick the impact will be. And I started in one camp before I wrote the book. I was sort of one of the first people to write about, beginning in 2010, about the new impact of AI technologies on skilled jobs like lawyers, doctors, things like that. And that said, the reality is that these things may take longer to arrive than some people expect. I mean, now there's a whole, Martin Ford is a great example, a whole school of people who believe, essentially the point of view of a computer science like scientist like Moshe Vardy, who argues that virtually any human task will be within the grasp of a computer or a robot by 2045. I've actually become more skeptical that those changes will come that quickly. I think there'll be dramatic things that will happen, but I think that there will be plenty of work for humans throughout our lifetime, yours and my lifetime at least. So,
well,
maybe not.
I want to discuss that a little bit more. More and more of the stores where I shop, and I'm sure for you where you shop, are replacing the checkers of cash registers with do-it-yourself checkout stations. And I always avoid the do-it-yourself option, which shows you where my ethical concerns are, whenever possible, because I don't like the idea of putting people out of work. So I've tended to demonize the approach that puts people out of work, but you managed to achieve a more balanced point of view. So maybe you can tell us something about the pluses and minuses here.
I'm actually very sympathetic with your point of view. I'm not sure that we actually disagree. I think that system that you're describing, where they force you to do your self-checkout, I think that's actually an interim step. And that my sense is that the cost of sensors and the RFID tags that now are starting to be on everything is coming down quickly enough that probably within the decade you will simply walk out of a store. And the checkout process will happen as you walk out.
Okay, yeah, that's certainly conceivable.
And so what about those jobs for checkers? And, it's a huge category of the workforce, and I think that is actually one that I could see a scenario where it might vanish in the brick-and-mortar world, and they might be replaced. You know, there would be more people who would be there to assist you rather than to charge you. There would be sales associates. So there wouldn't be an absolute vanishing of all human contact. There would probably be maybe even more human contact, but the role of the people in the purchasing process would change.
Hmm. Well, that's a bit optimistic, I think, because when I go to Costco, that's not what I see.
Exactly. And when you go to Amazon, that's not what you see either, right? That's another model. But it's complicated, is what I keep saying. For example, let's look at what's happened in the world of ATMs and human tellers. Because, in fact, even though President Obama said in 2011 that there were fewer human tellers because of ATMs, that's not what's happened. What's happened is because of the falling cost of telecommunications and computing, there are now branch banks everywhere on every corner you can imagine. And, you know, it's like Starbucks. They're everywhere. And so as a result, the number of human tellers has actually stayed flat. And what's vanished are the people in the back office. It's like a neutron bomb has gone off inside the bank, and all those people who move checks are gone. So there has been a huge impact. And let's do a thought experiment on another type of employment that could be easily replaced by technology, and that's the barista. And try to imagine a Starbucks without any humans in it and what it would do to the experience and whether people would go to Starbucks, even if they could get a nice latte or what have you. And I actually think that it's a more complicated problem than just saying, okay, this job can be done by a machine, that job's gone. In that Oxford study that came out recently that tried to rate the percentage of every job category and what chance they'd be of being eliminated, and I think they came up with an aggregate number that 40% of all jobs were at risk within 20 years or something like that. And when I began to look at the job categories, I just thought, you know, this is ridiculous. For example, one of the job categories that they said was 98% likely to be eliminated was pedicurist and manicurist. And I just think that's ridiculous. I don't know if I'd be the first one to offer my fingers or toes to a robot.
Yeah, but they're using them for surgery. How about your
Well, those are teleoperated. Remember, they're teleoperated. That's an example of IA. Okay, that's there. You can use robots to basically extend the capabilities of humans, and I think Intuitive Surgical is the best example of that for your spleen. The human surgeon can operate being less invasive in principle and operate inside your body. I've gone and visited Intuitive, and I've seen their next generation surgical robots, and what they focused on is not automation, but on augmentation. The coolest thing about the next generation of Intuitive Surgical robots is they have great vision, and so the surgeon can see inside the body in ways they never could. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very neat. So once again, it's a design issue. I think that the evidence on what's happening to the workforce is in America is extremely murky. I read the debates between the economists over job displacement, and I am yet to be convinced that the kinds of things that Jerry Kaplan and Martin Ford, who are both friends of mine, and I've read both books, and I think it has to be proven. I don't think it's a certainty that that will happen to the workforce. What they believe will happen to the workforce will happen on the time frame that they say. For example, let's talk about the job of a driver. 3 million people make their living from driving, trucks, taxis in America. I do not think that that job force category is going to be dramatically affected in the next decade. Despite Uber's investment and Google's investment, I think that the edge cases and the issue of liability is tremendously an unsolved problem at this point, and not clear that it will be solved in the next decade to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another issue that was brought up by called Shadow Work by Craig Lambert, who's written a book about that, referring to the unseen, unpaid jobs that fill our day. And so I'm thinking of that checkout scenario where I have to go and, figure out how to run my products over the scanner and get my card in and all of that, which you say is going to go away. But there's so many places in our lives now where it seems like more and more work is shifted to us. That used to have people, as a professor, we used to have, they used to be called secretaries, and then they were called personal assistants. But what the wonderful computer did was to, I used to play tennis with my students and kind of hang out and be available. When I go to the university today and I look around, everybody is staring at a screen. At a screen. And I found, I'm now retired from the university, but I found that I had less and less of that sort of hanging out time, because now I was so empowered to do my own typing, publishing, blah, blah, blah. It was taking up all my time.
It's a great point. Did you see the Times piece about Amazon and the new form of measurement of employment? There was really a striking piece about sort of the work culture at Amazon.
Yeah, I think I did see it, but take us through it again.
Well, so the piece sort of probed the culture of this very intense workplace. And I think probably you could say it for many companies in Silicon Valley. It's not just Amazon. But in Amazon in particular, was an example of the kind of, remember, which I'm forgetting the name of the Charlie Chaplin movie in the 1920s about...
I'm not that old.
No, but we all saw this when we were growing up. There was a Charlie Chaplin movie that focused on automation.
Yes, and I do remember that.
And, this notion that you can measure every aspect of a person's productivity and somehow, improve it by keeping an incredibly detailed and a record of it. And, of course, the sensors that we have now make that possible, that you can instrument everything that a human does. And... it creates a kind of grim world, right?
Yeah.
The one that you're kind of describing, where we work all the time.
Yes.
And not clear that productivity goes up, but we're instrumented. I mean, that's one of the interesting things. There's a huge debate right now about productivity in American society. And it's, you'd think, given all this technology, that you'd see this exponential
increase.
Yes. It's actually episodic. It's very much a puzzle. It comes and it goes in national, and there's a debate. Some people believe that they can't measure it correctly anymore, and then there's this kind of technology that you've mentioned. For example, what's the productivity impact of having access to Google? No one knows how to sort of measure a free good and what impact it has.
Yeah.
And that's a fascinating discussion. But I don't think that there's a clear evidence on productivity or what's going on with the structure of the workforce, even. The more I read, the more confused I get.
Great. Okay, and let's see here. So as robots and other sorts of artificial intelligence take over more and more of our work, it seems inevitable to me that large numbers of people will be displaced from the workplace. And I've complained that we don't have an economic model to support that situation. Our economy, even as it exists today, guarantees, then this is the Marxist critique, that a certain percentage of people will be unemployed. But there's a huge stigma attached to receiving government aid. So I think I've, you know, for some time thought that we need an economics that somehow acknowledges the fact and destigmatizes government aid. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, let's see. First of all, to the issue of the Marxist critique, because it's interesting that the new technologists and their view of the impact of automation technology is very Marxist. I mean, overproduction and underconsumption is their vision. I've come to a much more Keynesian view of things. That, you know, remember Keynes in the 1930s sort of asserted that technology destroys jobs but not work. And his argument was that, you know, there's this thing that the economists talk about as the lump of labor, this belief that the pie stays the same. And in fact, the pie continues to grow. GDP tends to double, and the nature of the workforce changes. You know, we've gone from the beginning of the last century, if you want to be really sort of secular, more than half of the population was engaged in agriculture, and now less than 2% of the population is engaged in agriculture. And yet, more than 140 million people are working in the economy now, more than ever in history. And so then people come back to me and say, ah, yes, but workforce participation has declined. And I go, yes, that's true. It's historically low, and it might be for reasons to do with the recession. But in fact, when you start to pick that apart, there are lots of reasons that the workforce participation has declined, and probably the aging of the baby boomers is the biggest explanation, not technology. You know, you and I just didn't get the memo about retiring, but many of our our colleagues did. You know, and they've started to retire, and they're not in the workforce. But there is, I admit, there's tremendous underemployment. We're in a gig economy. People move from job to job. So, in response, particularly to your point about aid and support, I'm mixed on that. I mean, I've read all the literature. I think it'd be a very difficult political thing to basically guarantee a basic income in America right now for ideological reasons. There have been some fascinating experiments in India where they've done that in villages, and instead of creating a lazier population, which is the theory of the conservatives, right, they've actually empowered people, and they've gotten much more entrepreneurial behavior, which I think is very exciting. But I actually think that the best way to respond to this new reality, which is sometimes described as the gig economy, people don't have a single job for their entire career, but they go through a series of different kinds of jobs, maybe at 3 or 4 or 5 year intervals, or even quicker, might be to essentially subsidize education. Don't support people just to support them, but to support people who are willing to be retrained. Maybe guarantee an education for anybody who's unemployed and needs a new skill, and make it possible for the workforce to be more fluid. I mean, we've done this experiment on a grand scale with the GI Bill in the past. Why not, basically create raw material for a very sort of dynamic capitalist economy? I think it would make our society more competitive. That's a theory. Yeah. I don't consider myself a social policy person. I'm more interested in, you know, the people who design these systems and sort of their values.
Yeah, and one of the things that's coming to my mind is this, and I forget what the term is, but the big discussion going on right now about the great disparity in incomes and all the capital getting, stuck.
Well, it's
stuck in the top 1%, so that education's not happening in the way that it needs to be happening.
Yeah, sorting that out is really really interesting. My friend Jerry Kaplan argues that this rising this rising scope of inequality in society is an artifact of technology, and I think there probably is a technological component, but I think You know, tax policy probably plays a large part too. And once again, I don't know if you can blame computerization for rising inequality completely.
Well, it goes back to we've seen the enemy, and the enemy is us. You know,
yeah,
and the way that we have structured things. You know, one of the interesting optimistic views is Ray Kurzweil's theory of singularity. I don't know if everybody in my audience has heard about that, so
sure.
Take us through that scenario.
Sure.
A bit.
So this singularity is a term that was first, I think, coined by John von Neumann in the 1950s, a mathematician, but it was popularized in the 1990s by a computer scientist and science fiction writer, Werner Vinge, who's a wonderful, one of my favorite science fiction writers. And he sort of made the observation that because of the accelerating speed of computing, that computers would surpass human intelligence. I think he picked 2023. I think Kurzweil says maybe 2040 or something like that. There's a range of times. But there's the assumption that machines will become super brilliant. They'll have superhuman intelligence. And there, of course, is the corresponding fear that when they're smarter than us, for some reason, they'll decide to destroy us, which is an interesting hypothesis. Not clear to me why that would happen. I think you mentioned Her at the beginning of our conversation, and I think in the movie Her, they just get bored with us and they go off to do something more interesting, and that seems like a probably more likely outcome to me. But I have a lot of difficulty accepting the, I'm a devotee to science fiction. I love reading that stuff, but I see no evidence that we're approaching machines that are self-aware or super intelligent. I have a piece in the paper today that describes some of the progress that's been made in developing AI programs that can take tests at a human level. And they've succeeded in building a program that will take an SAT test, the geometry subset of the SAT test, and get about the average level of 11th grader at this point. But they still have problems with very basic things like trying to understand what an arrow is in a diagram on a test in context. Not a solved problem for computers. And I don't see the rapid progress that Kurzweil assumes will happen. I don't see any evidence for that. And I see big, big problems in sort of that path to super intelligent machines. Herbert Dreyfus is a University of California, Berkeley philosopher who in the 1960s sort of looked at these attempts by the AI field to make progress toward thinking machines. And he said, you know, writing these programs as working toward artificially intelligent machines is a little bit like climbing to the top of a tree and asserting that you're making steady progress on the way to the moon.
That's great.
I think there's an interesting parallel.
That's a good one. Let's talk about conversational systems. That's particularly intriguing to me, what with the movie Her and my relationship with Siri. I feel like I could almost go there.
I that's actually, of all the things that I've written about and explored as a reporter, that's one of the most intriguing things to me, because I do see the progress there. Over the 35 years that I've been reporting, I've watched voice recognition, speech recognition, natural language understanding. I've watched great progress, and now we're to the point where you can begin to converse with the machine. I wouldn't say it's a human-like experience yet, but we don't have a machine that will pass the Turing test, but there are machines with which you could have a commercial conversation about making a purchase or doing something else. And I wrote about this after the book, but about a month ago in the science section of the Times, I wrote about a Microsoft experiment in China called Zhao Ice, translates Little Bing. And it is a chatbot that's intended to be a conversational system, not to be like Siri. Siri is a program that's intentionally designed not to have long conversations with you, but rather to be a productivity tool. You ask it a question, it does something for you, or it tries to answer the question, and you go on with your day. Zhao Ice, in contrast,
you're saying it. I say she.
That's interesting. Well, I could say she. I have a woman's voice in my Siri, and I thought about changing it the other day to the Australian or the English version because I was looking for something that was a little more upscale. Zhao Ice is fascinating because there are 20 million users. 10 million of them are intense users, meaning they have multiple conversations that have multiple, components every day. And 25% of the Zhao Ice users have typed "I love you" to Zhao Ice. 50% have typed "thank you." There's that to me is. It's something that Sherry Turkle, who's a psychologist at MIT, worries about a tremendous amount. She thinks that there's something deeply empty about having a conversation with a machine. And I guess I don't think about it in an emotional setting. I mean, that's what she's thinking about, is people replacing human friendships with machine friendships.
Yeah.
And how lonely a world that would be. And it's funny. I think about the scenario I think about is this scenario in Knowledge Navigator, the Apple Vision video from 30 years ago, in which an absent-minded professor had this office assistant that helped with his daily tasks. And I can see that being both useful and actually possible.
Yeah, I must have missed that video because that doesn't ring a bell.
I'll send you a pointer.
Okay.
It's great fun.
And I mentioned that for the newsletter I put out, I had been writing about her and these other artificial intelligence-related films. And one of the conclusions that I came to was that I thought was pretty outrageous, but I put it out there anyway, was to say that I think that at some level we want our machines to love us. And as I was going through your book, I actually found things that seemed to support that. And it sounds like Shirley Turkle is also. I wasn't concerned about it. I was just noting it. But
yeah.
It sounds like she not only notes it, but is concerned about it.
I think that's true. And I guess I can't. I looked at it. I was very influenced by the perspective of Alan Kay, who was the person who designed the first modern personal computer. And we had a conversation about conversational systems. And one of the things Kay sort of alerted me to is this passage in something that Hegel wrote called the master-slave dialectic. Hmm. It was in the Phenomenology of Spirit, and I remember it vaguely from my days as an undergraduate in philosophy. But I went back and reread it, and Hegel talks about the effect that the slave has on the master. And argues that the master is dehumanized as much as the slave. And Kay thinks about that in the terms of the relationships we design with these machines. If we're increasingly treating these machines as if they were human, then the nature of the relationship makes a great deal of difference. And that's a design question. And, he pointed out to me that we can design these things as slaves, or we can design them as our masters, or ideally we'll design them as partners. And I see a Siri as an example of a machine that interacts with you as if she is a partner in my mind, and that's an example of good design. I could see other approaches as well.
Yeah. I imagine somebody will design one of these things that will have a nasty temperament, and once there was a program for the Apple II, and one of my sister's boyfriends was over, and this program, I don't remember the name of it, but it would hurl insults.
Yeah.
And this guy got so engaged with it, and he was calling him names, taking it at a very literal level. Now, I'm sure you saw, I don't think you wrote it, but I read a story just a few days ago in the New York Times that Barbie wants to know your child.
Yes.
And that Mattel has invested a huge amount of resources in conversational systems with, I think they said 700 lines of code, which doesn't sound like that many.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
But, And one of the, so of course that raises all sorts of psychological questions that people have about, geez, do I want my little child saying I love you to her doll?
I think that's a really fair question. I look at it from a slightly different point of view. There's research that's been done over the past decade at UCSD about providing robots to toddlers, to really young kids, to basically teach them language skills. And I was very influenced. I have been very influenced by my mother, who's now no longer alive, but she was a special education teacher. And I remember her sort of being in despair because she spent a lot of time in the East Palo Alto school district, and you know, where there were lots of learning issues.
Yeah.
And she felt that one of the great challenges she faced is that by the time the kids reached her, when they were six or seven, it was already too late because they had this kind of deprived situation at home where they hadn't picked up the language skills that middle class and upper class kids do. And the thought that you could perhaps give a kid a very inexpensive robot that could be a conversational companion where the family broke down and wasn't working and could fill that role, that was a really intriguing idea to me. I don't know if it's possible, but if the family isn't providing those skills and a machine could, why not?
Yeah, you know, I think you made reference to one that I had not heard of called Jibo.
Jibo, yes.
Jibo.com, if people want to check that out. And I guess it's a crowdsourced project that hasn't quite reached completion yet. But it's sort of like, it reminds me of the lamp animation that, that the movies uses that lamp animation that turns its head and jumps around. So it's a robot, I would say, that sits on your desk and is able to converse with you and turn its head around and look at things and put expressions on its little computerized face.
Right? Yes.
I want one.
It's about to ship. And, you know, Amazon has a product called Echo that doesn't serve as a robot, but it does serve as a sort of a Siri on your kitchen counter. And you can order things and you can ask it questions and what have you. So that's starting to become technology that's accessible to just about everybody. Apple's probably going to do the most advanced effort to make it possible to converse with your television. You'll have Siri technology with your TV shortly. The Jibo project is interesting. I worry a little bit about the surveillance implications and how they can promise me that, you know, Big Brother won't be listening to me. It feels a little bit like 1984, doesn't it?
That's a good point.
How do you trust these systems? And I think that has to be solved yet. And of course, there's it's not Jibo, but there's a Japanese robot. I'm blanking on the name at the moment that is going to be arriving in households. And these things have threatened to become commonplace for a while. This is one of these issues that I sort of subscribe to Sappho's point of view: never mistake a clear view for a short distance. It's going to take a while for somebody to get it right and for this stuff to be an obvious thing you would want in your house.
In my favorite science journal, the New York Times, along with the New Yorker, there was a piece, and I think some videos accompanying it, about the robot in Japan, one of the first robots that they had there that was a little bit humanoid, you know, could roll around and so on, that Sony decided that they weren't making enough money on it because they had only sold something like 360,000, and so that wasn't enough. And so they discontinued it, and people were so attached to it that there's a whole business around people who can manufacture parts, who can fix them, and so on. And adults, not children, were extremely bonded.
That's Aibo.
Yeah, and that's a fairly primitive version, right, of a robot.
I agree, and you know, there's some talk about Aibo coming back. Sony is talking about getting back into the market.
so, So this maybe is a good, you know, can segue us into your last chapter of your book, which you title Masters, Slaves, or Partners. And you take up the plight of our aging population and the role that robotics might play. So as somebody who is on the cusp of perhaps experiencing that scenario, take us through it.
Yeah, so this is...
not you on the cusp.
Yeah, well, me too. Believe me. I'm old enough to retire. There's a really lively debate right now about whether it is technically possible to have an elder care robot and whether it is preferable. I mean, I don't know if you saw one of my favorite movies is called Robot and Frank. Have you seen that movie?
I think it's been some time.
A person with early stage Alzheimer's is given a robot and he's an ex-crook and he uses the robot for all kinds of extracurricular activities. Very fun movie. But so I think the first thing to say is that if you think about the kinds of applications that an elder care robot might be good for, I mean, and the general point is to allow people to be independent longer, to not have to go into assisted living facilities. That's the goal. And so there's a whole series of things that a robot might be able to do, ranging from helping people remember day-to-day things to helping people drive, to helping people pick things up off the floor. I think the sort of the end goal is a robot that could be dexterous enough and strong enough to help someone take a shower. A very intimate task where now you have a healthcare professional doing this, usually a low-paid one. So is that the right thing to do if you could do this? First of all, I think we're more than a decade away from that being even remotely possible. That level of robotics is just beyond the reach of the technically now. Then you get into the question of whether it's sociologically or socially preferable. And, you know, there's a really interesting discussion that's going on now, and there are people who argue that this is sort of inhumane. And you sort of, you know, think about the possible irony in the title of my book, you know, All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. There's kind of a creepy possible sort of scenario, though, of people who are no longer in contact with each other. And I actually think that's possible, but I don't think it's inevitable. I think you could have a set of technologies that would allow people to keep their independence and it will allow people to keep human contact. And why I come down on that side is that I've, you know, now sort of been involved in the death of two parents, and I'm watching my wife care for her 94-year-old father who has Parkinson's. And, if there was an assistive technology that would allow her to be able to be in contact with her dad but not have to be responsible for his care and the way she is, I think it would actually be a really wonderful thing.
It's going to be interesting to see how this evolves as our generation, as the baby boomers and younger, move up into this old age scenario who have grown up with technology. Because right now I know people, I actually overheard a conversation recently in the restaurant where the couple behind me, they're trying to persuade their elder person who's with them how easy it's going to be if they get an iPad and how they'll be able to have video conversations with each other. And you can see them sort of almost trying to drag this person in with all sorts of trepidation, and will they be able to understand it and use it and so on. And so it'll be different for those of us who, we already know how to use an iPad and such, whether or not we can stay on that technological gradient as it continues to get more and more complex remains to be seen. Do you know anything about that or have any observations about the degree to which people are actually taking advantage of I guess, social networking, et cetera, who are in the category of maybe being in an old age home?
Yeah. My own explorations with my mom were frustrating. She was at that juncture, but I think that's a generational point. I mean, I think we're that cutover generation, and every generation after us will be totally comfortable. And I also think it's a design question. I actually think that good design will make these things simpler, and the user interface will appear transparent, and that is actually sort of where things are headed. You know, that's what they refer to as ubiquitous computing. The computer disappears, and an everyday device becomes magic. And the more transparent it is to the user, the more magic it is, and the better the design is. So I think the thing you're describing is an interim sort of challenge. Like, remember how cars were hard to operate? You know, you had to crank start them.
Oh, yeah. I do remember that.
And then they standardized the interface, and I think that will happen over the next decade.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that seems like a reasonable extrapolation.
Yeah.
You know, at a personal level, what would you have become if you had not been a journalist? Was there another path?
Well, you know, my first, in terms of a career, for a while I thought I wanted to be a social scientist. I was in graduate school and backed away from that because it was more of a, being a sociologist when I got into graduate school and understood what it was as a profession. I didn't want to teach. I was interested in research, and I realized that I got to do all the good parts of sort of research about the social impact of technology as a journalist without having to worry about teaching. So yeah. I went in that direction. So I think, once upon a time, a long, long time ago, I wanted to be an astronomer, and calculus sort of foiled that. I struggled with calculus, and I realized that that wasn't going to happen. So no, I've wanted to be a journalist right from the beginning, I think.
Uh-huh. I never aspired to become a market research consultant as a little boy. That never occurred to me. But I was admitted to an electrical engineering program, ended up shifting out into creative writing. And what got me into market research was my desire, was seeing that this big thing was going to happen called personal computing. And boy, I wanted to find a way to take part. And so it turned out that market research was a way to get a front row seat, much as you did with journalism.
Well, that's neat. Yeah, the PC sort of swept up an entire generation.
Yeah.
We were both part of it.
Hey, John, I want to thank you so much for your generosity and for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me. It was fun talking to you.
I have to say I really appreciate John's patience and generosity with his time. It turns out that Skype was down at our scheduled time. I've been using Skype for more than 10 years and have never known it to go down. John and I kept making false starts only to be told that one or the other of us did not have a connection. We tried periodically over a period of more than 2 hours past our scheduled time. Thank goodness we were finally able to connect. I couldn't believe that we ran into the trouble that we did. I was particularly excited to be interviewing John, since I've been a fan of his and the Wings ever since he interviewed me so many years ago, and since I've been seeing his stories in the New York Times and elsewhere during the intervening years. And then, of course, also to interview him in the wake of Terry Gross of National Public Radio's Fresh Air, who is certainly one of the best interviewers out there. I joked with John before our interview got underway that perhaps the artificial intelligence underlying Skype was deliberately sabotaging us, anticipating that we'd be saying some critical things about AI and robots. I'm hoping that you out there are seeing the relevance of my interest in artificial intelligence and intelligence augmentation for a psychology show like this. Of course, the study of artificial intelligence has historically been important for cognitive science. I think that quest has helped to clarify a number of issues in regard to human thought, and also has raised important ethical considerations that need to be faced. I think it's become clear that machines will not think using the same processes as our brains. Our brains still have massive computing power and incredible associational matrices that are beyond today's technology and perhaps even far into the future. However, by taking approaches that do not attempt to replicate our brains, we are seeing that very powerful approximations are increasingly successful in narrow knowledge domains. More importantly, however, the key thing is that for better or worse, our lives are increasingly going to be embedded in a world saturated by so-called intelligent devices and systems, some of which will perform better than us in their assigned tasks. This inevitably will have psychological and emotional and social impacts on our individual and collective psyches. And for that reason, it's very important for all who are interested in psychology to be aware of and to question where this is all going. As Markov writes in his last chapter, robots as elder care workers, service workers, drivers, and soldiers are an inevitability. It is more difficult, however, to predict our relationship with these robots. He goes on to say, in the end, the emergence of intelligent machines that largely displace human labor will undoubtedly instigate a crisis of human identity. So once again, the title of John Markoff's book is Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots. If you'd like to order it and at the same time help to support Shrink Wrap Radio, please go to our site and click on the Amazon.com banner ad that you'll see in the right-hand sidebar.
Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for a while, so I thought it was high time for me to make a donation for a couple of reasons. First of all, you've pointed me in the direction of some very interesting authors whose books I have bought and obviously paid for. So I figured it was only fair that you get a reward for your own work. And secondly, these long, in-depth interviews are sort of a niche format, produced almost exclusively by independent podcasters who rely on individual donations to cover their own costs. So I'd like to appeal to all your listeners to step up to the plate and make a donation. Thank you very much for all your good work.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's nice to have my work recognized in such a solid way. I appreciate your support, and I hope others will be inspired to join you. I'm pleased to announce some recent donors who've been added to the honor roll on our site. Carol Agrimson, Jeffrey Backstrom, Meredith Pitt, and welcome back Simon Huggins. Do you have a website? If so, you might have experienced what I did a couple of years ago, which was an outside attack on my site. The company that saved my bacon is called Sucuri, and you can find them at sucuri.net, and Sucuri is spelled S-U-C-U-R-I. They're an industry leader in security options for websites and blogs. I use them, and you should too. And as an affiliate, we'll get a small portion of whatever you spend there. So just go to the Sucuri banner ad in the left-hand sidebar on our site. Speaking of sidebars, please patronize our advertisers in the right-hand sidebar on our site. There you can get Dr. Robert Hedaya's herbal pain remedy to fight inflammation, and it's appropriately named Unflame, and I use it. And also you can click on the banner ads there to purchase books from the authors advertising with us. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, I have the perfect recommendation to accompany today's episode. In fact, it's the book we discussed in today's interview, Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots by John Markoff, and it's read by George Newbern. It's nearly 12 hours of intellectual stimulation. Here's a brief sample.
Of course, together, their work defined both a dichotomy and a paradox. The paradox is that the same technologies that extend the intellectual power of humans can displace them as well. In this book, I have attempted to capture the ways in which scientists, engineers, and hackers have grappled with questions about the deepening relationship between human and machine. In some cases, I discovered that the designers resist thinking deeply about the paradoxical relationship between artificial intelligence and intelligence augmentation. Often, it comes down to a simple matter of economics. There is now a burgeoning demand for robots with abilities that far exceed those of the early industrial robots of the last half century. Even in already highly automated industries like agriculture, a new wave of ag-robots are now driving tractors and harvesters, irrigating and weeding fields, conducting surveillance from the air, and generally increasing farm productivity. There are also many instances where the researchers think deeply about the paradox, and many of those researchers place themselves squarely in Engelbart's camp. Eric Horvitz, for example, is a Microsoft artificial intelligence researcher.
So, if you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that's not to your taste, they have more than 180,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hey, this is Marcia Scarborough, author of Honey in the River, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Marcia Scarborough, who in fact will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. I'll read a couple of recent emails from our listener community today. First, we hear from Randy Westfall, who writes in response to my recent interview with Kim Hermanson on the transformative power of metaphor. And Randy writes, "A very good interview with Kim Hermanson, who knows a lot about metaphor. During the exercise toward the end, I was working with the image of a yellow rope that did not help me to climb a mountain, getting out of a ravine. Having previously worked with Robert Haas's color chart, I identified my motivation but not the answer to move forward. In the exercise, I pictured the yellow rope as a ray of sunlight, which took the literal definition away and put the metaphor back into the image for me. I won't go into all the detail, but this works for the interpretation of my situation. Big thanks goes to Kim and Dr. Dave for this radio show." So I'm glad to hear that you were able to make fruitful use of that metaphor exercise that Kim led us through. Next, we hear from grad student and longtime listener John Knight in Australia, who writes, "Good day, Dr. Dave. I just finished an assignment on multiculturalism in counseling, and the provided Edith Cowan University study guide for referencing electronic sources used shrink wrap radio as an example, citing the Robert Scare episode. Thought you might get a kick out of that." Well, thanks for letting me know, John. And I'm not sure if you knew already or not, but I'm already cited in the APA style guide, which I really got a kick out of. And for listeners who don't know, Edith Cowan University is in Western Australia, and evidently they have their own style guide, and now Shrink Wrap Radio is in it. Hooray for Australia! So we'll wrap it up with that for today, and you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can use you can leave voicemail using our app, which you can find out about in the Apps tab, or you can use our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, John Markoff, for sharing his insights into the world of artificial intelligence and robots and their implications for all of us. My next interview will be with return guest Marcia Scarborough, whom I interviewed way back on Shrink Wrap Radio number 153 about her book Medicine Dance, A Shamanic Journey. Well, the shamanism continues in her latest book, which is titled Honey in the River, Shadow, Sex, and West African Spirituality. Whoa, that sounds like a good one. So, I hope you'll join us. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.